This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series.
Alrighty, well, thanks once again to our two fabulous readers for this evening. And I guess now I get to ask Justin questions. the first story, that creature that showed people their true selves, is that actually based in Hebrew mythology?
No, it's not. I guess it's kind of an amalgam of several threads of interests. One was clearly fascination with the desert. I went to the desert in Morocco and Algeria many years ago, and started to write a story then, and had about 10,000-15,000 words written, and decided that I'd try and make a short story from it. So it kind of got some threads. Clearly, you know, it's got some Jewish elements in it with Moses and the bitter herbs and a bit of supernatural stuff. But there's nothing specific about that in Hebrew mythology. I did have a name. You know, they were meant to be Tuareg tribesmen, but I just took the name out in the end. So they're not necessarily Jewish, they're probably...
The second story, all about Sir Walter Raleigh, obviously, about to be executed for something like my knowledge of Raleigh's history is sadly lacking at this point. It sounded like it was something that you'd actually been to the Tower of London and you'd been thinking about the people there. Is that how it came about?
It is a known fact that in his life he'd walk 14 steps between his quarters and this wall and then turn and walk back again. So he literally walked his life, pondering his, you know, what he'd done and what had happened to him. And basically he was out of time. He was Protestant and Catholic times. So the Stuarts were Catholics. Elizabeth was Protestant. And once she'd gone, and times changed. So that was his time. What I loved about the sea and the freedom of the sea was something I could put into that story. And he kind of captured something that interested me. And in fact, if I had the space, I would actually do the steps. Because it's actually got the steps in it.
Yeah, it did sound like you were aiming for some sort of rhythm there. The novels, like the Atlantis bit is presumably some sort of introduction to it, is it? That there's all this mystical stuff that is going to happen to the Atlanteans and then we'll move on to Egypt.
Sort of, yeah. The story is meant to, you know, set the scene really for the novel and the novels to come. And the end of the story, the end of that chapter is obviously meant to be ironic in some way, which the reader finds out in due course as to how ironic it's going to be. Like metamorphosis, they're going to change this bit into what? So that's what the story is about.
Well, I suppose changing into something is one step up from all being dead because Atlantis is under the ocean.
Well, yes.
Moving on to Kevin, can you tell us a little bit more about this series of books for kids who are not terribly into reading?
Badgerlonian, the company, and they basically sell packs of books into school, and recently they've always been for the younger age group, really, and I've written for them before with that. And then they've now moved into teenage reads, so, you know, and pushed the sort of horror and the supernatural to try and get us, you know, it's the kind of thing that trying to get kids to pick up books, but if they want to pick up a big novel because it's intimidating for them, it's not necessarily, the writing's not necessarily any simpler than you would expect to see in a so-called proper novel. It's just the size of the story and the fact it's very much marketed at them. And the idea is it goes into schools, the teachers have work packs that go with them as well, of ways to develop a story afterwards and things like that. So we're on the second series. We had 8 stories out last year, and then we've got, earlier this year, and we've got 8 more out next week.
Well, that sounds like a really, really worthwhile project. Congratulations on being involved with it. Now, of course, my favourite part of the evening, being a complete superhero junkie, I have to ask you, who are the other members of the Omega Squad?
So the Omega Squad, they're Sovereign, who is basically Superman. There's the Dark Stranger, who wears a cowl and a cape. And no one, he's the only superhero in the world now that no one really knows his identity, and he keeps it secret from his other co-team members as well. There's Sunburn, who is a Human Torch character, and Sunburn's story is the fact that he's gay but not allowed to be by the superhero team, who want him to be a Johnny Storm character and out and being one the ladies might like, and he's not actually interested in the ladies at all. There's Quickfire, who's the speedster, who's the ultimate darling of the sort of like the Heat magazines and the kind. And then there's Atomic Boy, who is actually a 47-year-old man who's trapped in the body of a 16-year-old since the atomic accident that created his powers. So he's actually slightly older than the person that he's a sidekick to. So these are the groups. And Jaden, who's the main character in the book, has a link to one of them that he doesn't know. And it all becomes very clear when the superhero dies and things start changing.
I think I might have to buy it.
I'm in the wrong genre.
Well, you know, I like the ancient Egyptian stuff as well. So when you finish, yeah, you've got a trilogy though. Right? Yeah. So you've got a lot of work to do. All right. So has anybody got any questions for just our readers? Joe.
Yeah, I've got questions for Justin. I know when you were drafting the novel, I know you had several problems with it, and I know you particularly had a problem with point of view and writing in the point of view of a teenage girl. So I just wondered how you managed to overcome that.
A lot of it was with your help, actually. Thank you very much for that. Because, I don't know, there's just a very small... It's very subtle, the change in the point of view. I don't know... I think part of the problem I had was that for many years I'd written kind of technical material and actually historical researches. So I was used to a kind of reporter type style. And it's probably taken 5 or 7 years of writing to actually fracture that and to try and get inside characters' minds and emotions. So I think just due to repetition and your help.
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously a skill to be able to give all the characters different voices. And something I noticed as I was reading Nomad, Joe, is you've got a lovely voice for the little girl. Alrighty, any other questions? Come on, somebody else must be a superhero fan here. So why did you decide to make Quicksilver / The Flash the girl?
I never really thought about it because she was always in my exercise book from when I was 11. She was a girl. She's always been the girl in the team. There are a few other girls that will come into it later on as well as we go on. Like all superhero teams, it seems to be there's one girl and a load of blokes, but actually perhaps there's going to be a reason in the story why that happens, and that will change quite dramatically later on in hopefully book 2. But she was always meant to be. There's no, actually we don't know if the Dark Stranger is a man or a woman yet. In true Battle of the Planets style, because no one knows what's under the mask, so no one knows.
Very mysterious. When are you going to finish this book?
My plan is I finish it at the end of July. So then it goes into the...
Ready. Any other questions? Jonathan, were you waving your hand there? Yes, good. Roz.
I just want to ask Justin, I got the impression there when you were talking about your travels through Nigeria and stuff that these stories have maybe percolated in your mind for a long time. And I was wondering if you actually are the kind of person who sits on a story for a long time, goes back to it, revises it, or if I've got the wrong impression and actually that you write them as soon as you think of them. And clearly you're doing a lot of research, so just if you could talk us through a little bit about what the process of writing is like for you.
Just suffering from deja vu here at the moment, so I suppose when I see the way a lot of other people write, I seem to have come to writing the other way around, because I have done a lot of research in my life, so I find I don't necessarily, I can dip back into that research and pull stories out. This particular one, yeah, I suppose, you know, she was in Morocco in what, I don't know, 1976 or something ridiculous. I don't think I wrote about it then, but I wrote about it when I started writing about 7 years ago, because it was such an evocative experience. So, and that's when about 10,000 words came out. And then when I came to look at doing some short stories for this piece, I thought I could make a short story out of what I'd written and amazingly reduce 10,000 into 1,000. So I know it can be done. So, I mean, that took me, I don't know, about a week. I suppose it went down about 1,000 a day or something. And gradually, you know, I suppose you've got to work out what the nub of the story is that you're trying to tell, because there were so many threads in the 10,000 words that there were too many, obviously, to pursue in a flash fiction piece. So.
I was just asking Justin if he thinks he could have written the 1,000 words straight away, or if he needed to write the 10,000 words to figure out what the 1,000 should be.
It did occur to me to just try and do that, but it seemed to just fall out in the end that, I mean, I don't know if it came across as an integral, cohesive story. It's difficult for me to judge whether it seems a standalone or has bits that stick out. But I think probably in short stories, there are always bits around the edge that a writer can't see, but a listener can. For instance, in the story about Riley, I wondered if I needed that little anecdote about Alice. It's difficult to know, because a short story is often a series of anecdotes, so that sort of make a cohesive whole. So.
Pete?
Question for Cav. Is there anything that you've learned from writing comics and scripts that you've brought across to your other prose?
Well, good thing about writing licensed work is that you work with so many different people and so many different editors, and every time I write something, I learn more. The difficulty for me when I started to write prose was that my background, other than I was a magazine journalist by day, and then I wrote audio dramas and comics, so I was quite good at pithy dialogue, but then realised that doesn't make a very good story. And so it was working then with different people to then build up the fact of describing, because I was relying on the actors' voices and the artists to tell a lot of stories. And it was a very collaborative work. And so now, yeah, it's now, I've learned by working through some of the fiction I've done since, and how to build the scene more without relying on that. And hopefully, but then the flip side of that, hopefully the dialogue is, he says, worryingly, quite realistic and, you know, easy to read, because that's what my bread and butter is now, that I write scripts, therefore they have to be easy to read, so the actors can actually read them. So try to get sort of a truth in them in that way.
Now, back to my favourite subject. You mentioned that in the world of this book, the superheroes have taken the place of pop stars and sports stars and whatever as the celebrities that, that everybody worships. Now, that's not a traditional part of superhero comics. I mean, when they get in the media, it's normally because J. Jonah Jameson is complaining about what a menace to society they are. So I guess there's a certain amount in the movies. I mean, Tony Stark obviously fancies himself as a cross between Steve Jobs and Brian Cox and whatever the latest pop star is. And there's a certain amount, particularly at the end of the Avengers movie, where you see the media reaction to all of that. But this is really, you know, not typical superhero stuff. So could you talk a little bit about that?
I think my thinking for that, really, it stems from Marvel and what Marvel did with the Civil War miniseries they did. I mean, for people who don't read comics, well done. You've probably still got a life. Civil War was this event Marvel did where post 9/11, people didn't want secret identities and they didn't want masks. And Tony Stark was very openly saying, look, we've got to be public and we've got to register. And Captain America said, no, we need to protect the vigilantes. And they had this sort of fight, and it got you thinking about, well, what would superheroes be really like? So in the world I'm creating with through the Omega League is the fact that the superheroes are sanctioned and they're trained. And as soon as a superhero breaks out, to use a Tomorrow People phrase, the Omega League pounce on them and they get sent to boot camp and they get taught how to be a superhero and they get given an identity and they get given a code name, and sometimes it's the code name that someone else wants, and they become franchises basically. So they're officially sanctioned and they're very corporate in their existence.
Yeah, I like that. Back many years ago when I was running a Golden Heroes campaign, the British superheroes, obviously, and they also had to get themselves officially sanctioned by Parliament. They didn't much like the idea of working for Margaret Thatcher, but they had no choice. But also, one of the things I did was, at the start of every game, I would give them the newspaper clippings about what had happened to them in the previous game, to see how the various newspapers, and obviously these were done in the style so that the Sun was only interested in pictures of the female superheroes, and the Telegraph was fulminating about how evil superheroes were, and the Guardian was full of spelling mistakes.
Part of my thinking behind it is actually from a logistic point of view. When these people fight, there's a lot of damage, so the licensing pays for the structural repairs of buildings and the psychological damage of the victims. So the Omega League is there to license the arse off the superhero, because they need the money to rebuild Britain and America and Russia and China every time one of these guys decides to duke it out.
So Cabot Circus is going to get rebuilt then?
No.
Pete?
Just a comment on that, really, that Powers is similar. It's kind of that they've got these celebrity status, but they're all very... got lots of dark secrets as well because of that, but I guess that's not quite the same.
No, and the thing, yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a trend in comics, because I think it has to be, because superheroes can't exist as they were. And let's face it, the Daily Planet will spend all its time trying to work out who Superman is, which might be problematic for one of its employees. So, you know, that's why, again, in this world I'm creating, there aren't really any secret identities, except for a couple. And one of the big things is that when the superhero dies, who isn't the Dark Stranger, the big shock is who he actually is, because he was one of the last sort of golden age heroes, the Sovereign, who people were sort of like amazed who it was. And that has the ramifications later on.
Yeah, no spoilers. Any other questions? You are allowed to ask a question if you want, Justin. You can ask it to yourself.
I was going to ask him a question.
Go on.
Very short.
So, this is the Omega League, isn't it? Yeah, so I think you're being very clever, because clearly the second series will be the Alpha League, won't it?
Well, there's Alpha Flight that Marvel already own, and actually probably DC might have something to say about me using the word league, but I did call them the Lionhearts for a while, but someone here is writing superheroes at the minute with a team called the Lionhearts, the bastard. And the thing is, his is published first, so I've had to go fall back. But it's the name I gave them as 11, so for me, the Omegans, or the Omega League, is still quite... I get a little twinge of nostalgia for something that didn't really exist other than my exercise books at the time.
Wasn't there a character called Omega Man? Yeah. Probably, yeah. And as you've now been fingered as a writer of The Lion Hearts, Mr. Howard, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, well, as you may recall from the last reading, I did a chapter from one of the stories, which is Goon Squad, which is Manchester's superhero team, which are associated with the police. All these teams are associated with the police. London's is a bit different in that they're about twice the size of anybody else's team, and they're franchised, and they wear spandex, and they're gorgeous, and they have auditions, and every other team in the country hates them, and they're the Lionhearts. So that's where they come in.
They're not owned by a Russian oligarch, by any chance?
Not directly, no.
Maybe in a later episode. Any more questions for our fabulous reader? No? Well, in which case, thank you ever so much to Justin Newland and to Kevin Scott. We, of course, will be back here in a month's time, and Claire isn't here to remind us who we've got. So, never mind.
Some people.
Pete, yes. Yes, so Pete Sutton and David Roger will be entertaining us next week, next month, even, in June. Good. So I look forward to seeing you all then. Thank you very much.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.